The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is the second in our series on a Jewish books tour. And I think the goals of this particular class are quite beyond the parameters of this class. But we'll see how far we can get. When we talk about Torah, generally people think of the five books of Moses. In fact, there are 24 books that are called the Chaf Dalet Kitvei Kodesh, the 24 holy writings, that are included in the words, in the written tradition that we call Torah. And to make your life easier, I'm going to give you a chart, because I find that people sort of always want to know what this is and that is and where this fits. And what I wanted to take a look at, briefly, is the prophets, the writings. What this unit, known as the Navi, sometimes it's called the Navi, sometimes it's called Nach, which I'll get to in a minute, right? Sometimes it's included in the Torah, and yet it's different from the Torah. How this works, what its value is, how do I go about studying it, and what to do with it. So let me just give you a chart, which will make this maybe a little easier. This is from a book called The Commentator's Gift of Torah. You can really find this to some extent inside this book, right, in sections. But I just thought that, you know, inside the Chumash, inside the Torah. So we already discussed the first section, the first unit. If you look on this list, you'll see that it says Pentateuch, Penta meaning five, right, the five books of Moses. And then it has a separate section that's under Torah for the last eight verses. And then I've got the prophets, and then I've got the writings. So we're not really going to get deep into the writings. I'm going to treat prophets and writings for the moment as a unit that's different from the five books. Now, does anybody want to venture a guess as to why the last eight verses of the Torah, of the five books, are different from the rest of it? Anybody? Because that describes Moses' death. And it even speaks after Moses' death. There's a big debate as to who wrote those words. Did Moshe write those words with prophetic insight? Or did Joshua write those words after Moshe? There's a whole discussion about this. So for the moment, we'll call that a different unit. Then I get to the prophets, to the Nevi'im. Yes? Okay, that's also a big debate. That's a big discussion. In other words, did Moshe write it in sections? Was it all written somehow or given over to him up on Sinai and then concluded? Many traditional commentaries perceive the tradition that's been given down is that Moshe wrote it in units. In other words, for example, the book of Deuteronomy was a speech that Moshe made at the end of his life. And at the end of giving that speech, or right before giving it, he wrote it down. And that's the book of Deuteronomy. And therefore, the eight verses would then be written after Moshe died, by Joshua. There is, by the way, one very, very, very important idea that's contained within this. In other words, the perception being that Joshua wrote the last eight verses. I mentioned this as a question when we had our last class. It's really difficult to understand. Why, if the whole purpose of getting out of Egypt is to get to the Holy Land, to get to Israel, then why is Israel not in the Bible? Why, when I finally am about to cross the Jordan River and get to Israel, do I end the five books? Why is that the book of Joshua, which seems to be on a lower level, or a different level? So, it seems, at least from a vantage perspective now, that the major difference between the book of Joshua and the five books is that one is transmitted by Moshe, by Moses, and one's transmitted by Joshua. And we spoke, if you remember, a little bit about the difference between Joshua and Moses. And the fact that Moshe...
Is that part of it still supposed to be the Bible?
Pardon?
Is that part of it written by Joshua?
Okay.
The final bit, the last eight verses.
That's still in the Torah.
Yeah, but it says it's super late to come from God.
Oh, so now you bring me to another question. There is a common ground to the Tanakh, to the 24 books that you see listed here before. And that is that they are all divine. Some are the actual word of God, and some are divinely inspired. And we discussed actually last class that one of the differences between Moshe, from a traditional perspective, and every other prophet, and again, this to me is not only valuable in terms of what we'll get to that in a minute, from a traditional perspective, is that Moshe somehow transmits without affecting, somehow, some miracle, a relationship with God and Moshe, that God is able to give a word to Moshe, and Moshe can transmit that word exactly as it was given to him. Whereas prophets, when Jeremiah comes along and discusses something with me, so as much as I'm getting a divinely inspired message, and the message comes from God via the prophet, it's affected by the prophet, and I'll get to that. That being the case then, if Joshua is different from Moshe, and therefore anything that's told to me by Joshua is not quite the level as is told to me by Moshe, so then what about those last 8 verses? So here, the reason that these last 8 verses are included in the Torah, and not the beginning of the... Because you could have started the book of Joshua by saying, you know, Moshe went up on the mountain, and he died, and he gave over the mantle of leadership to Joshua. Instead, that's how the Torah ends. As a matter of fact, this is worth looking at. Look at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. So till verse 5 of chapter 34 in Deuteronomy, God's talking to Moshe. Moshe goes up, God talks to him, okay. Now it says, and Moshe died there. Vayamat sham Moshe. Servant of God in the land of Moab. And he's buried in such and such a place. And he was 120 years old. And the Jewish people cried. And look at verse 9. And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, because Moshe had given over to him the mantle of leadership, whatever that means. And the Jewish people listened to Joshua, just as Moshe had commanded. And there was never another prophet like Moshe. And all the signs, right, etc. Now, I could have started the book of Joshua with these verses, because look now at the book of Joshua. And it was, chapter 1, verse 1, right, this is the very next stage. And it was after the death of Moshe, the servant of God, God says to Joshua, you know, Moshe is dead. Now you got to get up and cross the Jordan and take these people into the land of Israel. Moshe took them out of Egypt. Joshua brings them into Israel. So I could have began and said, Moshe died. He was a great prophet. Lived 120 years. Now God comes to Joshua and says, you go in. So why do I have this at the end? Very, very important idea. There's a Mishnah. It's a part of the oral tradition. We're going to get to the Mishnah, Bezrat Hashem, in one of these classes. So, but there's a Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, it's actually the first Mishnah of Ethics of the Fathers. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moshe got the Torah at Sinai. That's not an accurate translation, but we'll leave it for now. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. So Yoshua v'Yoshua l'skenim l'skenim l'nevi'im. The elders, the judges, gave it over to the prophets. And the prophets, u'nevi'im misarua le'anshei Knesset Gedola, gave it over to the men of the great assembly, who were in the time of Ezra, at the beginning of the Second Temple. So, there are two questions that are always asked with regards to this Mishnah, this teaching. The first most obvious question is what this particular Mishnah, this particular oral teaching, is doing at the beginning of the book called Ethics of the Fathers. It's a history lesson. Why do I need to know that Moshe gave it to Joshua and Joshua gave it to... I'm at the beginning of Ethics of the Fathers, right? I'm talking about how to be an ethical person. That you should always do acts of loving kindness, and you should judge your fellow man meritoriously, and don't judge a person until you stand in his place, and beware of evil, and all these different ethical teachings. And how do I begin this whole ethical series? Moses got the Torah from Joshua. Joshua gave it to the elders. The elders gave it to the prophets, and the prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. So what is that history lesson doing there at the beginning of ethics? That's the first question. And the second question is that there's a linguistic problem there. Listen to the words. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai umisara liYoshua. Moshe got it and gave it over to Joshua. VYoshua lizkenim, and Joshua to the elders. Uzkenim lenviim, and the elders to the prophets. Unviim misarua liAnshei Knesset Gedola, and the prophets then gave it over to the men of the great assembly. Now it doesn't have to say that. There's an extra word there. It should say unviim leAnshei Knesset Gedola, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. Why does it repeat the word that they gave it over? Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, it should say, Moshe gave the Torah to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. Instead it says, Moshe gave the Torah to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets gave it over. Do you understand? It adds that verb again. It doesn't need it in there. It's part of a list. It's one of those little details that you miss if you don't notice it, and it's a little detail which teaches the world. What cataclysmic event occurred between the time of the prophets and the time of the men of the Great Assembly? The Great Assembly was established by Ezra. Ezra was the exilarch, Jewish exilarch, appointed by Cyrus at the beginning of the Second Temple. When they rebuilt the Second Temple and came back, they discovered a spiritual wasteland. There was nothing there. The priests were intermarrying. Jews didn't know what Shabbat was, what kosher was, anything. And they had a temple, but they had no one to fill it with. And so Ezra does a whole bunch of things. He opens up schools. He teaches the people. And one of the things that he does is he sets up an assembly called the Great Assembly. 120 men. Some of these men, and these were the 120 greatest leaders of the Jewish people of the time. Prophets were included in this assembly. For example, Mordechai of Purim fame. Daniel of the Lion's Den. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Haggai, Tzfanya, Malachi. These were prophets. It was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It wasn't like when one died, they found another person. Because you could never fill the shoes of the people of that assembly. And when the last of them died out, and his name is Simon the Just, and he, interestingly enough, is the first person quoted in Ethics of the Fathers, because he is the end of the Great Assembly and the beginning of the period known as the Mishnah. So that was it. The Great Assembly was over. The first temple was the period of the prophets. Beginning really with Samuel, Shmuel, and going all the way through the famous prophets, Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. When the Jewish people went down into exile at the end of the first temple, Yechezkel, Ezekiel went with them. When they came back up, there were a few prophets still alive, but prophecy was finished with. In the second temple, there was no more prophecy. So prophecy really died at the end of the first temple. So what happened between the period of the prophets and the period of the men of the Great Assembly? What cataclysmic event? The destruction of the temple. The most challenging event in Jewish history. The focus of all of Judaism was destroyed. The Jews were sent into exile. They'd never had to deal with exile. They'd been in exile, but they hadn't been exiled there as a people. When they were in Egypt, they didn't have to deal with how to react to being out of Israel. This was the first time they ever had to deal with that. How do you keep the ideals going when you don't have your temple, and you don't have your land, and you don't have prophecy and your leadership? How do you deal with that? And then they came back and they built the second temple and they reestablished the schools. You might easily believe that the prophets weren't able really to fully communicate the tradition to the men of the Great Assembly. After all, they were in exile. So many Jews and leaders died. So much happened. So maybe we lost stuff. Maybe the tradition I have today isn't really what I received all the way back from Moses. And we'll talk about the importance of that when we get to the Mishnah in our books series. So this Mishnah makes the point of saying, Umisarua, and the prophets gave it over to the men of the Great Assembly. The Great Assembly, these 120 men, who had a couple of prophets, received the tradition in its entirety from the period of the prophets. So that the tradition, as it was handed down from Moses to Joshua, and from Joshua to the judges, such as Samson and Gideon, etc., Deborah, there were women judges, who then handed it down to the prophets, that tradition in its entirety survived the destruction of the temple and was embodied in the men of the Great Assembly. And that's important because of the answer to my second question. What is this history lesson doing at the beginning of ethics? What the Mishnah is telling me is that my ethics come from a tradition. And that tradition stems from a line that goes all the way back to Moses. And that Moses' ethical system came from God. And that everything that you are going to read in this Mishnah, in this discussion of ethics, which may be beautiful and may be magnificent, and may make a lot of sense to you, is valuable not just because it makes sense to you, but because it's a gift that we're given. And remember, I said that, you know, one of the challenges in studying this is, can you imagine what it would be like if this was a divine book? In other words, I said to you, imagine reading this as though it were divine. Well, the same is true with the ethic of Judaism. Pirkei Avot, which seems like a very man-made thing, the kind of thing you and I would come up with, of course you should assume the best about every person. Or at least it's very easy to say we should do it. Whether we actively do it is another question. The Mishnah teaches me that when I'm doing that, I'm not just doing it because it makes sense to me. This is part of the system of Judaism which comes from God. Now, why do I tell you all this now? Because that's exactly why the last 8 verses written by Joshua are in the Torah. Transition is a very difficult period. It's a very dangerous period. It's a period with great potential. It's not accidental. I mentioned this to you once. It's not accidental. I actually heard this from Rabbi Aaron. It's not accidental that the mezuzah is on the entrance to the home. The point of transition. The place where I'm going in and I'm going out. It's not an easy thing to leave the safety of the home. They say you're supposed to sneeze when you have it. It's not an easy thing to leave the safety of the home and go out in the world. And there's a lot that goes on. And very often we find ourselves in points of transition. And sometimes when you're in a point of transition, you can lose sight and focus of what it is. This is a tremendous period of transition. The Jewish people in the desert, they're essentially in a greenhouse. They're getting manna from heaven. They've got all sorts of miraculous events occurring, if we're to believe what the Bible says. They have a relationship with Moshe, who speaks to God. Now Moshe's dead. They're going into the land. Traditionally, when they enter the land of Israel, it's not given to them on a silver plate. The sea isn't going to split. God isn't willing to do all the work. Exactly as we mentioned this morning, God takes them through a Garden of Eden experience. Now they have to go and do it themselves. So now they have to conquer the land of Israel. There's a partnership, to be sure. Very difficult period, this adjustment. Recognize then that the leadership of Joshua comes from Moshe and from the divine. And that you shouldn't think that because Moshe isn't there, now we're talking about a different level. It's a chain. And I will go you one further. And this is a very, very strong idea within Jewish tradition. And where this breaks down and how it breaks down, that's a discussion for our class in Jewish books. But within Jewish tradition, in order for Jewish tradition to make sense, in order for it to be meaningful, it only is sensible and meaningful if I see it as a part of an unbroken chain. If Shabbat was somebody's idea 100 years ago, it may be beautiful, maybe not. But if my tradition of Shabbat is a tradition that's given down to me over the last 3,000 years in an unbroken chain, that puts a whole different spin on it. So it's very interesting as you go into the books of the prophets, that despite everything I'm going to tell you about how the prophets differed from Moshe, nonetheless, it's a continuation of the tradition that was established in the time of Moshe. And you'll find that even though very often the prophet can add something, just as the rabbis in the Talmudic period can add something, and just as rabbis today sometimes will add things, they will never detract. You'll never find in the prophets something that disagrees, that contradicts, that removes a tradition from the period of Moshe. That's a very important idea. If we have major issues that arise today, how do you deal with Friday afternoon candlelighting in 16 different time zones? Right? How do you deal with making a blessing on the new moon in outer space? All sorts of modern issue and science technology questions. Can I use a Shabbat clock to turn the lights on? A timer. So, the traditional system is such that in order to arrive at an answer, I have to be sure I'm not contradicting anything. Now sometimes there'll be a debate. Does it contradict or not? Okay, so that's legitimate. And that will usually be the basis of the debate as to whether something is permissible or not. Is ultimately, does it contradict that which came before it? Now, what do I care if it contradicts that which came before it? I mean, if it makes sense now, who cares? So they were wrong. But if they is the divine, well, that's a whole different spin. Okay? So that's an important piece of background. First of all, I mentioned before, you know, that the prophet, it's divinely inspired. That's the divine word. How does that work? So I want you to know that this is a topic that's discussed by the major Jewish commentators that I don't think I could personally cover in weeks. So I'm giving you a perspective, but I want you to realize you're not getting a whole perspective. And I want to remind you again that what we're doing here in these 3 weeks is we're whetting your appetite, giving you different pictures. And if a particular issue intrigues you, so you can pursue it, then that's great. You understand what I'm saying? So let me give you an example. If you read the beginning of the book of Yechezkel, Ezekiel, told you before that Ezekiel was all the way at the end of the line of prophets. He was the only prophet to prophesy in the exile in Babylon. Babylon is sort of a quasi. It's not quite America. It's Babylon. It's where the Talmud was written. But at the same time, it's not the land of Israel. So it's an interesting entity. But he goes down to Babylon, and he prophesies. And the beginning, the first chapter of the book of Yechezkel, is this incredible image. Mar'eh, Chazon Yechezkel. The vision of Ezekiel. And it seems to be a description of the first time Yechezkel sees God. So how do you see God? I don't know. I'm not really sure. But imagine if you were a human being, and you had a relationship with God, you were a prophet. And in that relationship with God, you actually saw an image of what God is. So what would you do? Well, you'd want to share that with everybody. You know, just like when you fall in love, you want to share that with everybody. Or if you fall in love with Judaism, you want to share that with everybody. So Yechezkel is all excited. And he wants to share. I saw God, I know what God looks like. So that's what he does. Of course, it doesn't do me much good because I read this vision and I don't know what the heck he's talking about. And it's very difficult to understand exactly what that image is and what I'm supposed to learn from it. It's interesting, by the way, that we read this image on the same day that we read the portion which describes the Jewish people seeing God face to face somehow at Mount Sinai, because it's the closest thing that relates to that in the prophets. So Yechezkel has this incredible image. Winged beasts, four-headed figures, flying in fiery chariots through the sky. If there is a God, and if God appears to you, I would imagine it would be very difficult to describe that in human terms. But Yechezkel tries. Yishayahu, Isaiah, who lived almost 100 years before Yechezkel, he also seems to have his, I ran into God the other day. The first time that he sees God. His description is much more toned back. I saw God. God looked like a chariot of this and a pillar of that. And okay, you know, it's like a verse or two. And then, let's get on to business. Here's what God told me to tell you. So the Talmud says, don't be fooled. Don't think that because Yechezkel gives this incredible description, this magical, fiery tale of his relationship with God, of his meeting with God, and Isaiah just has a couple of verses. Don't think Yechezkel is like this all the way up there. She Yishayahu ke ben Korach, or ben Ir, because Isaiah is as someone who lives in the city, and Yechezkel is like someone who lives out in the village. You ever see a tourist in New York City? Right, tourist comes to visit New York City, sees the Empire State Building. So the mouth pops open. You know, some guy from, I don't know, I couldn't think of a name without getting into trouble with someone, so. But imagine whatever you think of as Weeboken, Hoboken, Noboken, and a guy who's never seen a building more than two stories high comes to New York City, and his mouth is hanging out. And he's standing there, he's looking and gaping in awe at the Empire State Building. And some New Yorker, you know, he's running down to a business meeting, and this guy doesn't get out of his way. He goes, what are you looking at? It's the Empire State Building. He says, yeah. He says, look at it, it's unbelievable. Okay, have a nice day. Go back to Kansas. So Yechezkel, he was like, this was all new to him. Isaiah, he hung around with God. He was like one of the guys in the palace, you know. He had this relationship with God. He's like, yeah, you know, I saw God the other day. You know, we had brunch. You don't get an ooh of President Clinton if you're his, you know, national security advisor, because you see him every day for breakfast. Now, what does this tell me? Why do I bring up this story? Because it tells me that I have different personalities. And they have different relationships. And I don't have a way of judging better or worse, but different. With God. And this, to a certain extent, will color their prophecies. And now we get to the traditional approach. You have to understand what Judaism has to offer on this topic. You shouldn't make the mistake of assuming that because of this, that this means that a prophecy is subjective. That a prophet is given a message and he decides how to tell it so that it's man-inspired. No. What it means is that when I reach the period of the prophets, I already have the foundation laid. Let's say I'm building a building. And I lay a foundation. And someone comes along, he doesn't quite like the way it looks. He doesn't quite like the dimensions. He says, well, you know what? Why don't we move this a little bit over here? Ha ha. So the architect says, you can't move that over there. Because if you move that over there, the building won't stand. It'll collapse. You can't. But then, you know, 3 months later, the building is up and the walls are up. And everything inside is being erected. And he says, you know what? This kitchen door, I don't like this here. I like this over here. So he says, fine. If you want it over there, we'll put it over there. Because the foundations are already laid. So the five books of Moses, those are the foundations. The prophets, those are the kitchen walls. Now, you don't want to live in a house without any inner walls. I mean, if you're all living in different corners of the house, and the parents are in one bedroom, and the kids are in another bedroom, and then there's a guest bedroom, and there's two bathrooms, but there's no walls, well, you wouldn't want to live in such a house. But you can't at the same time compare the structure of those walls to the structure of the foundations. How do you know where to put your walls? Well, first you build a foundation, and then you build a house, and then you sit down, and you think about it, and you look at the different houses and different walls and different rooms, and sometimes you move in, and you say, you know what, I want to do this a little differently. I want to break down this wall, because now I need it this way. But you can't break down the foundations. So the five books of Moses are the foundations. And the prophets in different degrees and different perceptions, they're different walls in the house and different kitchen. Every generation has different needs. And that creates a certain problem. Because I need a Torah to be a living Torah. I need it to be adjustable. I need it to be able to relate to each generation and their needs and their perceptions. Their positive attributes and their negative failings. And at the same time, I've got a system which is divine. You can't change the divine. You can't say, well, you know what, Shabbat was great 3,000 years ago, but today, you know, today we have video. So we don't need Shabbat because we can tape it and we can do that Tuesday night. And Bible study is wonderful, but today I got email, so I don't need it. So how do you relate those two needs? So that would seem to be the Torah and the prophets. The prophets give us the sense that there are messages that are given over, that are inspired by the events of the time. The Torah is very much not like that. When the Torah comes along and says, "V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha," you shall love your fellow man as thyself, it doesn't say, well, you know, there were a bunch of Jews, they were beating up some guy, it wasn't nice. So love your fellow neighbor as yourself. No, that's an objective rule. The prophets, on the other hand, so the prophet comes out, he sees something, and he's divinely inspired by God. And the sum total of these messages of the prophets are meant to fill in the house. What is the Bible? The Bible is the Torah given to the Jewish people in the desert. It's the theory that will work, but they haven't yet lived with it. They haven't yet put it to the test. The prophets are that theory lived. Because now I'm living in the land of Israel. Now I'm sweating with this ideal, with this Torah perception. Interesting dilemma. If Yechezkel or Jeremiah or Isaiah had such a tremendous message to give, and by the way, I should mention something else, this is very, very important. There's a principle we have with prophecy. If a prophetic message is mentioned in the prophets, in the books, it's not a message which was meant only for that generation. It's a message which is eternal, which is supposed to be a truth that will last for every generation, for future generations as well. I can get a glimpse of this, and this is a tradition, it's a part of the oral tradition. If this message is so important, why isn't this message in the Torah? Why isn't it in the Torah? Elijah gets up on the mountain. Fire! Brimstone! And this unbelievable message. I mean, it's incredible what he has to say. It's magnificent. How come it's not in the Torah? How do Jews live without it? Because the Torah is the foundation. It's the system. But it's not enough just to study it. You have to live it. And the prophets are the Jewish people living the Torah in their land. That's, by the way, why the period of prophecy ends at the end of the first temple. Because they leave their land. It's why it doesn't continue in the second temple, because their relationship with God is not the same in the second temple as the first temple. They don't have as direct a relationship. So the impact of what they're doing isn't as great for future generations. Now this being the case, I've got now the prophets, and they're giving me these messages. So why is it that there are different prophets with different perceptions? Here it would seem that I'm learning a message, not just the particular message that a given prophet gives me, but I'm learning a message by virtue of the fact that the prophet is reacting to what the Jewish people are doing. In other words, what could God have done? You could make a list, and it wouldn't be that difficult, of all the different ethical teachings in the prophets. All the different messages. We don't have, by the way, that many mitzvot that come from the prophets. Muktzah, which is a, well, I won't get into what, but we don't have that many. So I could make a list. These are the ethical teachings. Don't do this, don't do that, do this, do that, whatever, fine. So why not just put them in the Torah at the end of the Bible? Because there's a certain point at which I can't be told something without living it. This message becomes valuable for the Jewish people because it's a reaction to who they are, where they are, when they are. And that's very important, because when you study the prophets, when you study the Nevi'im, you have to be there. You have to realize that when you're sitting with a prophet and having a discussion about a given event, that you're there. And that it means something to you because it applies to you where you are. That's a very important message. And there were certain messages that we couldn't or we weren't ready to accept in the desert. We had to be here and see them. You understand what I'm saying? Now I'd like to do two or three things with you. Okay? First, I want to give you a couple of examples of prophetic teachings, just so you understand what we're talking about. I'd like to also give you an idea of sort of how to study prophets, what to do, where to start, you know, what to work with, maybe a couple of the commentaries. Perhaps what we can do even is to take an example of a prophetic text and study that prophetic text. Okay? So those are my three orders of business. Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question?
Always.
I read that in that time it sent hundreds of thousands of Jews to reach the level of prophecy.
Okay, that's a very good question.
No.
We know in the prophets that there were schools for prophecy. I mean, one of the issues I'm not going to get to, you can imagine, because we keep doing this, opening windows, and then, you know, we don't have the time to deal with them. Those of you who choose to take the 3-year course, you know. But what is prophecy? How does one achieve prophecy? The Talmud, Maimonides, have phenomenal discussions about what prophecy is. Just as an example, we rule halachically that a prophet could not prophesy unless he was prophesying out of simcha, out of joy. Couldn't be a prophet if you were sad. Because prophecy stems from a certain relationship with God. And that relationship with God has to be a relationship of joy. And there's a lot more to that. For example, I can't teach someone else unless I'm teaching out of joy. Right? If I'm angry, I can't teach. And we see this in various instances. I think I even mentioned this on Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day. You can't teach out of anger. It doesn't work. But the prophets occasionally allude to the fact, there's a famous story of Elisha, who was the student of Elijah the prophet, meeting the B'nai Nevi'im, the students of the prophets. In other words, there were prophet schools. You could study to be a prophet. It didn't guarantee you would become one. But there was a way to study to become a prophet. You studied with prophets. You studied about prophecy. It's interesting that one of the main focuses of becoming a prophet was to do what? What would you imagine for a moment? You're going to be a prophet. Today you want to discover prophecy. So where do you go? What do?
Study what people should be doing, and you observe what they're not. If they're keeping in line with that or not. I mean, you look for signs.
Okay, so you go study prophets, let's say. But let's say today you want to be a prophet. You can't, but let's say you wanted to. Where would you go? I mean, so the general picture that people seem to have is you go off into the mountains. Mm-hmm. You know?
Today?
You go off into the mountains, and you isolate yourself. I mean, because that's what Moshe seems to do, right? He goes up on the mountain. He's up there for 40 days. It's just him and God. That's a common mistake. It's completely antithetical to the Jewish idea of prophecy. When Moshe went up to Har Sinai, he was already a prophet. You can't become a prophet away from the world. You can only become a prophet in the world. You know what you have to do to become a prophet according to the Talmud, whatever that means? Maimonides discusses this in his Guide to the Perplexed. It's a function of how you learn to behave. You have to be... I'll give you an example. There's something in Yerushalayim called the Jerusalem Syndrome. You ever hear of this? This is wild. There's a mental institution. It's in the south of Yerushalayim. It's got about 11, 12 patients. Sometimes they have as many as 25. And they have a specialty. They deal with the Jerusalem Syndrome. Jerusalem Syndrome is people who come here. They're touring, they're visiting, whatever it is. And they become convinced that they've had prophetic visions. They think they're the Messiah, they think they're sent by the Messiah, they think they're King David, they think they're Moses, all this weird, you know, at least so we. And they want a prophecy, and they want to change the world, they want to anoint themselves, they want to go up on the Temple Mount, you know, in certain instances they put themselves in great danger. You know, if you go into, through the Damascus Gate, and you're convinced you're a prophet, and you start walking around telling everybody, right, that they have to help you destroy the Mosque of Omar because the temple is going to be rebuilt tomorrow, you know, you get into a little trouble. So there was a famous family that came to a great Talmud Chacham, a great rabbi in Yerushalayim a number of years ago. They had a boy who was seeing their daughter, and he got hit with this Jerusalem syndrome, and he claimed he was a prophet. Claimed he was a prophet, said he was a prophet. And he was receiving prophecy. So you can imagine the prospective in-laws were a little nervous about this. They didn't know quite what to do about it. But on the other hand, how do you know he's not a prophet? Maybe he is. I want to know Jeremiah, who was a prophet in the Bible. So people didn't listen to him. They threw him in jail. Because he was prophesying that they were unethical, that the temple was going to be destroyed, that the kingdom was going to be destroyed. You can imagine the king didn't want this prophet walking around telling everybody this. And if after all, if they'd listened to him, then the temple wouldn't have been destroyed. So obviously they didn't listen to him. So just because there's a prophet doesn't mean you're going to listen to him. So they locked him up. So how does this family know that this guy is really a prophet or not? So they went to this great Talmud Chacham, this great Torah scholar, to ask him, is he a prophet or not? How do we know? So he says, look, I'm not a prophet. Probably takes a prophet to know a prophet. He says, but I will tell you this. And this is something that I gleaned from the commentaries and from the Rambam. Study his character. If he is a prophet, his ethic has to be on such a sterling level as to simply amaze you. He has to be the most incredibly ethical human being. He has to be such a good person that it shines from him. Otherwise, he's not a prophet. Now, I don't know the end of the story. I think they were too polite to mention the end of the story, but you can imagine. That's an idea of what prophecy is. You can't study to become a prophet up on the mountain. You study to become a prophet in Harlem, or on the New York subway system, or driving a car in Tel Aviv. Because if you can become an ethical person in a car on the streets of Tel Aviv, then you're an ethical person. It's easy to become an ethical person in the Beit Midrash. Tremendous idea. So there were schools of prophets. And there were tremendous prophecies. If you look at the book of Micha, there are only 7 chapters to the whole book of Micha. If you look at the book of Nahum, there are only 3 chapters to the book of Nahum. If you look at the book of Habakkuk, there are only 3 chapters, 2 pages. Now these were prophets who lived for decades. So how come we only have a little bit of their prophecy? Because the only thing you'll find in here are the prophecies that were meaningful for the Jewish people for generations, for eternity. But there were many prophecies that were given that were very specifically applicable. Some of them are alluded to in the Bible even. But they don't apply to me. If a generation is given a prophecy specific to that generation, but it doesn't apply to the next generation, then that's not going to be included in the holy books. Okay, so that's an important detail. Now, having said this, okay, I want to point out a couple of things. First of all, in terms of the authorships of the books of prophets, we won't get into this. Generally speaking, the books of the prophets were written by other prophets. Right? Samuel, for example, wrote a couple. Jeremiah wrote a couple. And I'm not going to get into who wrote what. But what makes these 24 books unique, through even the 5 scrolls, the book of Esther, which is late, which is almost the Second Temple, is that they were divinely inspired, and they were of prophets, about prophets, and by prophets. Because I couldn't write a book about Jeremiah and have it included in the Bible. So for example, I don't know, the book of Lamentations, which describes the destruction of the first temple, which we read at Shabbat, according to the Talmud, was written by Jeremiah. Okay? So that's first. In terms of getting a perception of who these prophets were and what they did, let me give you a couple of examples. Okay? Maybe one. There was a certain period in Jewish history where the Jewish kingdoms split into two. And there was a southern kingdom, and there was a northern kingdom. One of the great prophets, the Briot, one of the great prophets who prophesied in the northern kingdom was a guy by the name of Eliyahu, Elijah. And you can read this in the book of Kings. And Eliyahu had various different stories and miracles concerning his prophecies, and I'm going to share one with you. We have this sort of image, this tinted, rose-colored glasses look that we imagine that if you lived in the time of Elijah, it must have been incredible. Not so. There was a king at the time named Ahab. I don't know if he has anything to do with Moby Dick, but that was his name, Ahab. I imagine that the person who named his son Ahab in that book didn't know much about the Book of Kings because he never would have named his son Ahab. But Ahab was not he was not top of the line. He married a Phoenician princess from Lebanon by the name of Jezebel. And you've heard that name bandied about. She is not the most positive of characters. She had a very different idea of what a king should be. In Judaism, a king is a servant. He's a conduit to some extent between God and the Jewish people. But a king is not a god. A king is a human being. He's an ethical role model, and therefore he has certain responsibilities, certain demands in terms of ethics, that he has to behave in a certain way because he's being watched. Now, Ahav had a problem with the prophets, quite simply because the prophets reminded him of who he was supposed to be. He was the Jewish king, and not who he really was. And partly he had this problem, it seems, because Jezebel had him wound around her little finger. So he kills off the prophets. Until Elijah is the last prophet left in the land of Israel, the northern kingdom. And he goes into hiding. And he hides in a cave, and there's a miracle, and there's food in the cave, and birds bring him food, and all this different stuff. And there are at that time, according to Elijah, only 6,000 knees that have not bowed down to the Baal. Now there were at least 1 million Jews living in the northern kingdom, probably close to 1.5 million. There were only 3,000 Jews, 6,000 knees, that had not bowed down to Baal. That's an unbelievable thing, according to what he says. In other words, everybody was into idol worship. So you want to ask, wait a second, how could you be an idol worshiper if there's a guy like Elijah walking around? Elijah decides enough is enough. And he prays to God for a drought. There should be no rain. Now if Elijah prays for no rain, there's no rain, because he's Elijah, right? And this is the prophet, okay? Why didn't Elijah do it earlier? Because there's a certain responsibility to praying for no rain. Because there's a lot of suffering that's engendered. But that's what he does. And there's a tremendous drought. It's a 3-year drought. And there are no crops. There's no food. There's no water. And finally, Ahav, exhausting all of his other means and praying to all his other idols, realizes that this must be the work of Elijah. And he sends people to look for Elijah. And the word finally gets to Eliyahu. And Eliyahu says, forget it. I'm not interested in coming. You should all drown. You should all die of thirst. And God comes to him in a vision. God is not happy with Elijah. This is the Jewish people. Fine. So Elijah goes and calls. It's not exactly in this order. But he calls a mass assembly. And he says to the Jewish people, you know what? You all worship the Baal. I challenge the prophets of the Baal to a duel on the mountains of Carmel. And you can still go and see the mountains of Carmel just outside of Haifa. If you've been up there, the beautiful mountain range, which is exactly where this occurred, overlooking the sea. And they gather there, 400 priests of Baal and Elijah, and the entire Jewish people around the mountains, at least the northern kingdom. And they built 2 altars. And Elijah says, let's see which God will fire the altar of which group. And if your gods will set your altar on fire, the wood, then your gods will be the true gods. And if not, and my God will set my altar on fire, then my God is the true God. And then proceeds one of the weirdest stories in the entire Bible. It's unbelievable. You almost get the sense that he was so sharp, Elijah. He's known as the prophet of truth. He's just harsh. Tells it like it is. And there's a cynicism. As the priests of Baal begin to pray, you know, they set up 2 altars and they set up wood and they put the sacrifice in the altar. And they begin to pray to their gods. Of course, nothing happens. So Elijah starts to taunt them. Well, maybe he went for a walk. Maybe Baal is busy. Maybe he's in the bathroom. Maybe he's on the phone. Don't be so harsh. And they're screaming and they're flagellating themselves. And they're tearing out their hair. And nothing's working. And this goes on from the morning until the noonday sun is high in the sky. And until the afternoon. When the afternoon comes, then you know the Talmud says the priests of Baal weren't that stupid. They had a setup. You know, they had a little guy underneath the altar. And he was crawling underneath the altar with a little tinder. And he was going to light it. And he was like, you know, he was set up by the priests of Baal, according to the Talmud, you know, to sort of even the events. Well, but God had his messenger. So God sent the snake, and the snake found this guy, and he killed him under the altar. Now, whether that's literal or allegorical is irrelevant for the moment, but imagine if that was so, the priests of Baal up on top of the altar. Because they're convinced this guy is going to light the fire. So they're into it. And now they realize as hour after hour goes by that there's nothing they can do. But of course the whole people are watching them. So they're having a panic attack. And finally, they give in, and they challenge Elijah to light his fire. So Elijah calls Elisha, his servant, who will later become a prophet, and he gets water. And he douses his altar in water. Barrel after barrel of water 7 times. Till the whole thing is a big drenching pool of water. So that if the fire will consume it, it won't just be a miracle, it'll be a miracle. And then he stands up, and now he has the attention of the entire Jewish people. And he calls out to them. Hard, tough. What does he say to them? What do you think he says to them? How long will you? What do you think he says? No. I'm telling you the beginning of the sentence. Ad matai atem, how long will you? What? Right? Worship the Baal, right? Wrong. He says the weirdest thing. He says, Ad matai atem poschim al shnei asifim. How long are you going to straddle both sides of the fence? How long are you going to... What do you mean? That's not what he should say. He should say, how long are you going to continue to worship the Baal? But that's not what he says. It's almost as though he's saying, you know, I don't mind if you worship the Baal, but don't try to worship the Baal and worship God at the same time. What are the Jewish people doing? They have an insurance policy, right? You know, it's like a person gets in a car, there's a beautiful tefillah. Tefillat HaDerech. It's a traveler's prayer. So I know a lot of people, they get in the car and they offer up this prayer. It's kind of an insurance policy, you know. God, no God, you can't go wrong, you know, like, you know. You know, I'll take out the third party insurance. You know, okay, maybe it works, you know. Two, spit back 1,000 times, whatever it is, I don't know, right? So I don't laugh at these things, I don't know what they mean. But Elijah says, that's not what we're looking for here. You can't do both. You can't have an idol on your dresser and a Bible on your table. It doesn't work. In order to develop a relationship with God, you have to get rid of your idols. What are your idols? And don't think that everybody doesn't have idols. And then he calls out to God, and a fire comes from heaven. And it consumes the altar and the meat and the wood and the ground. And the people fall down on their knees. Hashem hu Elokim, God is the true God, they say. And this, by the way, is the verse that we say on Yom Kippur at the end of the fast. Now, I want to tell you something. Did I just pull this out of the wall? No? I want to tell you something. 2 things that are important to me. First, I don't know about you. I've been around this country. And I've been around a little bit, America, England, France. I never saw any Jews worshipping Baal. I never saw a big Baal store. You know, they don't have a, you know, get one Baal and your second one is free. So it seems to me that if my original contention is correct, that the purpose of these stories is not just for them, but for me today, so to them it made a lot of sense to attack the Baal, because that was a big idol. And by the way, when the Egyptians, I mean, Baal had a long history, he was a very successful god. It wasn't just a momentary thing. The Egyptians at the Red Sea encamped Mul Baal Tzifon, opposite the northern altar to Baal. Baal had been around since Egypt, the Jews brought him with them. But how come I have this today? So the very fact that it's in the prophets tells me there must be something today that I'm supposed to learn from. And of course that's very true. You think we don't have idols today? We have all sorts of idols today. People make all sorts of things into idol worship. Money can be an idol. The minute that I substitute an ends for a means, it becomes an idol. Money is a very valuable thing. And you can do a lot with money. And it can be a tremendous asset and a gift, and you can accomplish so much good with money. As long as you remember that money is the means to achieve something. But if money becomes the ends, if the purpose is just to have money, then you never get there. And it becomes idol worship. People can worship fame, fortune, pride. You can even make Torah study an idol. If a person wants to become a Torah scholar because they think that by becoming a Torah scholar, they'll gain respect and people will treat them in a certain way, and that's why they want to know Torah, then Torah becomes idolatry. Tremendous idea. And furthermore, says Eliyahu, Ad matai atem poschim al shnei asifim, you imagine that you can have both. Right? That's what we think. We think that we can treat money as an ends, but we also have our relationship with God. Says Elijah, you also have to be an honest person. You've got to be honest with yourself. As long as money is an ends and not a means, it doesn't mean that you have to go live in a shack. It doesn't mean there isn't a value to earning money. But as long as the money is the goal and not the means, it will always limit your ability to develop a relationship with God, to become an ethical person. Tremendous idea. So that's Elijah. I want to tell you the second thing that's important to me about this. You know what must have been amazing? Imagine the night after this incredible event. Imagine. You're Elijah, Eliyahu Navi. And you come home from Har HaKarmel. What do? I mean, you know, almost a million people have just seen fire come from the sky and devour the carbon. They've seen the destruction of the idea and the ideal of Baal, of idol worship. They fall down. Can you imagine getting 1,000 Jews to cry out, I don't know, Shema Yisrael at once? That would be amazing. Can you imagine 1,000,000? Can you imagine if you go to Meir Shearim on a Shabbat afternoon and there's people yelling Shabbos and there's people saying, you know, let the traffic by, and there's a few idiots in the middle throwing rocks, and you walk in there and you start making a speech, and by the time you finish, they're all hugging, dancing, the horror, and screaming Shema Yisrael. So they'd elect you as the president of the Gaimi. Unbelievable. So Elijah goes there, he does this whole deal, and 1,000,000 people are screaming, God is the true God. So what does Elijah do? He goes home. I imagine that night, he calls up all the principals of the Jewish day schools. He says, listen, I don't know what we're going to do, because tomorrow you're going to be packed. There's going to be no room. So spend whatever you have. We've got to get more chairs and more desks and no books. And then he calls up the synagogues. He says, listen, don't pray in the synagogue tomorrow morning, because 1,000,000 people are going to show up. There'll be no room. We'll pray in Central Park. So what happens the next morning? The same 10 old guys who make their way in order to get some herring, they're there. And the same 15 kids falling asleep during Hebrew school lessons are there. And where the other 1,000,000 Jews? They had a great experience. It was like intense, man. But they didn't get up the next morning. And Eliyahu, without quite going into the detail I just went into, he's beside himself. He rips his clothes. He goes off into the desert with no water. And he lies as if to die. And it's almost as though, if you read between the verses, he wants to kill himself, but he knows he can't kill himself, so he wants to allow for his own death. Because what's it all worth? I mean, if the Jews aren't going to develop a relationship with God, with fire coming out of the sky, give out! Then forget it! And God comes. And there's a really strange story. And God says to Elijah, where is God? Where do you find God? Now, if anybody else asked that question, I can understand the question. But if God asked that question, it's a little strange. Like, God asking, where is God? That's a little weird. And that's how you read that story. And the prophets tell me, well, Lo b'shamayim, God's not in the sky. God's not in the mountains. Kol d'mamadaka, in the still small voice, in the quiet of the wind. And what is the prophet trying to tell me? It's not in the bombastic event. You're not going to find God. You're not going to develop your identity as a Jew from the splitting of the Red Sea. You know what happens in the Bible right after the Red Sea is split? You know what the Jews do? They start complaining because they don't have water. How are we going to have water? We should have lived in Egypt. We're going to die in the desert. I mean, God, they just split the sea. Just destroyed the entire Egyptian army. No faith. Unbelievable. You don't develop a relationship with God with the splitting of the sea. You know when the Jewish people develop a relationship with God that seems to last? When they're in the land of Israel. And they conquer Jericho. And then they go to Ai. And a number of the men fall for various reasons and are taken captive. And then they go back and they attack again, and this time they succeed. Then they develop a relationship with God. You develop a relationship with God personally, on your own. Don't think you'll get a relationship with God by going to the big sound and light show at Madison Square Garden. Not that I'm, God forbid, saying that that can't be a wonderful thing. But if you really want to develop a relationship with God, if you really want to find out who you are as a Jew, if it's going to mean something, it's not a quick, feed me, intravenous fire injection. That's not how it works. And even if it does work, it doesn't last. It's the long, still night in the library. It's the long mornings in a synagogue thinking about it. It's ethical act after ethical act after ethical act of long distance run. That's how you do it. That's a message from one story in the prophets that you don't really find quite as clearly, as concretely in the Torah. And that's the value of the prophets. And I will tell you one more thing. We won't get a chance to study an actual text of prophets, but in a certain way, the way you study prophets is very much the way you study Bible, so that shouldn't worry you. But I will tell you one more thing. There's an incredible tradition we have. And this gets to the stage of how to study prophets. In the Roman period, the Romans, as in many empires before them and since them, decided they could never destroy the Jewish people physically. By the way, I can't explain this to you, but history seems to say that this is true. I don't understand this any more than Mark Twain understood it. But no matter how many times and how many instances we shouldn't be here, we still are. And I'll be honest with you, different people have a relationship with God that develops in different ways. Some people will prove to you there's a God. Some people will suggest that they have a relationship with God. And you've already gotten a sense of what my perception is. But I will tell you that one of the most meaningful days for me as a Jew today, living in our day, in terms of my relationship with God, are the 2 days that we just went through. When I look at Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day, and I look at Independence Day, and I look at Yom Yerushalayim, which is coming up, Jerusalem Day, at the beginning of the next program, and I get a sense of where we came from, where we are, to me, that has to lead you. I mean, for me, again, I don't tell you it should lead you, but it has to lead you somewhere. It's a message that's just difficult to ignore. So the Romans decided, if they couldn't destroy us physically, that they would destroy us spiritually. Which, by the way, is exactly what the Nazis decided, and the Crusaders. So it became forbidden to study Torah. Rabbi Akiva was put to death for studying and teaching Torah in public. And you weren't allowed to read in the Torah. Now the Romans had informants, and they would send these informants to synagogue to sort of check up on things. And if they would catch a synagogue reading the Torah, then the next day those Jews would be rounded up and put to death. And we know, by the way, from Josephus that this occurred, from Herodotus, that this occurred. So the rabbis had to come up with a system. Halachically speaking, if you're going to be put to death, so you don't do something, and yet a Jew without Torah is like a fish without water. So what do? Instead of reading a portion from the Torah, they would read portions from the prophets. And they were apparently a different type of scroll. It was a smaller scroll. And they would read a portion from the prophets. And this reading would sort of remind the Jews at least of the idea of that weekly Torah reading. And remember, you know, in those days there was no printing press, they didn't all have a Bible in their room. There was one in the synagogue, and there wasn't even a synagogue, there were public gatherings, whatever it was, right? So the rabbis chose a particular portion of the prophets that would fit with the particular portion of the week that would have been read from the Torah. Hence, as I mentioned before, the vision of Yechezkel of God, which was read the week that you would normally have read the Ten Commandments. Many years later, when the Roman Empire went the way of the Roman Empire, and the Jews again were able to study and teach Torah in the open, and again the custom of reading the Torah publicly, Shabbat morning, was reinstituted, they decided that because they'd had a custom to read the weekly portions of the prophets every week, and it had been accepted among the Jews, and it was a good thing, they shouldn't annul it. They shouldn't abolish it. They didn't have a Sanhedrin anymore, a high court to abolish it. So therefore today we not only read a portion of the Torah, but we read a portion of the prophets. And you can learn a tremendous amount about the portion of the week in the Torah just by studying what portion of the week in the prophets the rabbis chose. Because these were rabbis in the period of the Mishnah who chose this. More, because they're divided up into sections by the rabbis who were the greatest scholars of their day 2,000 years ago, so it allows you in certain instances to take a unit as a unit that's already broken up for you by someone who must have known tremendous amounts of Torah. So, why do I tell you all this? Because if you want to look for a good way to start studying prophets, the Nevi'im, the Ketuvim, I wouldn't start from the beginning. The first few chapters of Joshua are very powerful. But then you get to the whole splitting up of the land of Israel, the division among the tribes, etc. It's a tremendous amount to learn there, but if you're not ready for it, it's very dry. And you have to know what you're looking for, etc. So one way to study prophets, which is a magnificent way to get an introduction into this type of study, is by looking at the weekly Haftarot. And the way to do that is to get a Chumash or any of these, English Bibles that you'll find in the synagogues, and you find out which portion it is, and then you can study that portion of the week. Very powerful. Which brings me to the next point, and that is that if I'm studying prophet, well, how do I study prophet? So part of this is very much like the study of Bible. The same system. The assumption that it's divine, perhaps. The reading, and then the questioning, and then the studying. In terms of commentary, So here the commentary, it's a little more difficult, because the variance on certain levels is not quite as clear. So I will mention maybe two or three commentaries that I think are magnificent. Okay? The first is the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, medieval commentator. And by the way, if you want to look up a good list of commentators and where they're from, etc., Nechama Leibovich, who you'll remind me another time, I'll tell you who she was, has a set over there. If anybody's curious, you can ask me and I'll show it to you right after class. And she has in her introduction, or at the end of the book of the volume on Genesis, she has a list of all the Bible commentators that she uses, and a short paragraph on each of them, which is enough, you know, for an introduction, just to know who it is you're studying. So you can look up Kimchi, the Radak, you can look up Rashi, you can look up the Ramban there. It's a wonderful list. And he very often has short, terse comments, and the occasional little bit of a lengthy one, which are magnificent. The other commentary that I think is also tremendous, and these are both, the Radak, I don't know if the Radak is translated into English, but the Abarbanel definitely is. The Abarbanel, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, was also a medieval commentator, late medieval commentator, who was exiled into Portugal from Spain in 1492, and wrote in exile a commentary on all of the prophets and writings. Tremendous commentary. And he works very much in the system I've been describing. He asks you a whole list of questions, and then he gives you a treatise in which at certain points they say, oh, and this answers my fifth question. Oh, and this answers my second question. This answers my ninth question. So it's a little lengthier, but his language is so clear and so succinct, it's very valuable. And then, of course, there's also Rashi, which is very valuable. One more thing I wanted to mention. There's a Judaica press. Archcroll, I think, also has this version of the prophets, which has like an introduction, a history of the particular book. If you're studying Joshua, if you're studying the book of Jeremiah, when did Jeremiah live? Who was Jeremiah? What were the events going on at his time? What was the historical background? There's one that's put out by Judaica Press. It's like this reddish, pinkish set of volumes. There's another one that's put out by Artscroll. They're both, I think, very good. And there's another one that's put out by Sansino, although that's not quite as detailed. With prophets, especially if you're reading the Haftarot, and this is, by the way, a wonderful thing to do if you go to synagogue on a Shabbat morning and they're actually reading the Haftarah. The words of the Haftarah are very powerful. And I can only speak to you personally if you develop a relationship with them. But the messages that are contained there are tremendous. And very often, they're worth the read, even just to get a sense of the beauty and the poetry that the prophets spoke with, in terms of ethics and in terms of how we're supposed to relate to our fellow human being and how we're supposed to look at life and how to find the relationship with God, etc., etc., etc. So that's a nutshell encapsulation of what the prophets were and what these books are. And that now, I hope, you look at this book, and it's not just a glump, but it's different units and different sections, and you can study them. And I want to tell you one last thing, and that is that this is all an open book. And you'd be amazed at how much you can learn on your own. You go to a Judaica press, it's just a question of the motivation and the desire to study it. And you read an introduction to who Yechezkel was, and what he had to say. Or Isaiah, magnificent prophecies of Isaiah. And you study when he lived, and what he did. And it enriches you. And when you look at that from the perspective of who you are and where it is that you're sitting and studying this, and that you're reading the words of a prophet from 2,500 years ago, in some cases 3,000 years ago, determining that we as an unethical people, or as a people who hadn't yet learned to listen to its own ethic, would be doomed to be exiles from the land, but that one day we'd return. And you're reading that, sitting here, on that return, it gives you a whole different perspective. We have an advantage, we have a gift, that we can read the prophets from a vantage point that our great-grandparents couldn't do. Because we've already sort of seen something that they didn't get to see. So that's just a tremendous aside. Anyway, that's food for thought. Now that we've sort of taken a look at the written tradition, now what we have to do in our next class is we have to take a look at the oral tradition and what that means. And I hope, in addition to becoming familiar with certain texts and how they work and what we can get from them, alongside that, maybe we'll also be able to get a sense of why it is that there are so many Jews who sit around today and nitpick about some detail that some rabbi 100 years ago came up with, and how does that relate to my relationship with God on Mount Sinai? How did I get there? Why do I have to listen to them? Where is it that they get the gall and the arrogance to make all these decisions for me today? Or is there somehow some traditional idea here that's supposed to be magnificent?
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.